Hello. Once again, it is my privilege to be joined by Donald Freed, who, along with Raymond Briggs, has co-authored the book Killing Time, The First Full Investigation, published in hardcover by Macmillan. The book contains a wealth of information people have not heard, most cases, concerning the O.J. Simpson murder case. Now, of course, the civil trial is on, yea, verily, even as we speak. Don, welcome back to our airwaves.
Thank you.
Now, we were talking about the presentation that you and your author, your co-author, set forth concerning the discrepancies in the case, some of the physical evidence, and I want to get into a very important reenactment that you did with regard to the Bronco in just a minute. We've heard a lot about the blood drops, and we heard a lot about how this was the absolutely incriminating evidence linking O.J. Simpson to the case beyond a shadow of a doubt, and yet you point out that the blood drops themselves not only occur in some very strange places, unaccountable places, but that the actual nature of the blood drops, the shape of the drops on the ground, are not consistent with those with the drops that would be left by a fleeing suspect.
Yes, this matter of blood and DNA, the so-called mountain of evidence, and now listeners to your program, I want to call on your the uttermost of your critical faculties, because we have to deal semantically very carefully. We are told that blood drops traced to Mr. Simpson through the process of DNA testing were found at the scene of the crime. Now, you know, DNA and blood traced to someone is not found at the scene of the crime. What's found at the scene of the crime is evidence, blood evidence. That blood evidence then enters a process. It is collected and enters that process or that chain of evidence. And in a given time, over after a passage of time and at different places, that is, so that time and space are involved, an equation emerges of more or less matching a given individual, if it's DNA. But that passage or process involves human beings, laboratories, storage, and all the components of a chain of evidence. So when the defense argued garbage in, garbage out at the trial, and the jury embraced that concept, that was based on events that took place in that chain of evidence. Now, listeners are familiar with the fact that Detective Furman both said and did things which aroused the gravest suspicion. They're also aware of Detective Van Adder, who took a sample of Mr. Simpson's blood and had it under his control. But many of them are not aware that we learned this summer from Gary Sigular, who works for the coroner's office, that that same Detective Van Adder had gone to the coroner's office on June 15th, 2 days after the murder, and demanded samples of the victim's blood. And therefore, between June 13th and June 16th, Detective Van Adder and perhaps others had under his control samples of all the principals' blood, Mr. Goldman, Ms. Simpson, and Mr. Simpson. In that same time period, from June 13th to June 16th, listeners may be stunned to learn that the evidence collected at the crime scenes was not turned in. Whether it was in refrigerators, whether it was in paper bags, whether it was in reference samples, it was not turned into the police lab until the 16th. Therefore, in summary, all of the evidence and samples of all of the principal's blood was out of the chain of evidence, wild, out of control, and in the field between June 13th and June 16th. Now, I say that as a back. You are now armed with the basic logistics of the blood evidence, and you, I think, should have that in mind when you now ask yourself, is it really possible, is it probable, isn't it improbable that all of the blood could have been contaminated? When you ask that question, remember, you're asking, is it more or less improbable that the blood is all contaminated? Is that more or less improbable than the prosecution scenario, What you are not asking is it more or less improbable than a clear, obvious, logical, and stipulated answer? Because no such answer exists, or there wouldn't be this enormous controversy, and there wouldn't be this national crisis. So you have to choose between two improbable scenarios. And before you make that final choice, you should look more clearly at the prosecution scenario in terms of the timeline. And when you've done that, then I think you're equipped to make that decision. But I should say this. The suggestion that the jury was too stupid or too black or both to understand the DNA is an infamous suggestion when you realize that Dr. Kerry Mullis, the Nobel Prize winner, who invented the test that the state used for the DNA, was prepared to testify and indeed told our researchers, and we quoted in the book, that the test as conducted by the state, his test, was, quotes, worthless, close quotes. So we're talking about the Nobel Prize winner. He took no money, by the way, nor did Dr. Henry Lee, the world's greatest criminologist, employed by the State Police of Connecticut. When he said about the blood evidence, quote, something wrong, close quotes, those words, worthless, something wrong, that means garbage in, garbage out. Dr. Lee took no money. Now, Dr. Terrence Speed from Berkeley, who works with law enforcement often, testified that the prosecution's 1 in 5 billion, 1 in 6 billion, 1 in 50 billion mathematics about the DNA was, in fact, completely wrong, that the figure should be 1 in 200. Now, while it's true that 1 in 200 is also a very high percentage, yet Dr. Speed, who took no money, and I stress this because we've heard that you can buy experts, and we know that you can buy experts. We're talking about world-class experts here. The three big names took no money. They did not know Mr. Simpson. They have nothing to do with sports or Hollywood. In fact, they suffered punishing insults from their professional circles for daring to associate themselves with this case. Now, the jury was most mystified and shocked when Dr. Robin Cotton, speaking for the Cellmark Laboratory, a famous lab, when asked by the defense on cross-examination, what is your reference base for the DNA in African Americans that you've based your 1 in 5 billion figures? The answer was, quote, two African Americans in the Detroit area, close quotes. That's two African Americans. So when you begin to look more closely and you realize that the great experts in this case were on the defense, that science turned against the prosecution in this case, and though they had no knowledge or friendship with Mr. Simpson, you have to ask yourself why and what was going on, and whether or not the media, by not putting quotes around mountain of evidence and by using it as a given fact, didn't lead the country into this nervous breakdown that followed on October 3rd last year after the verdict, by pointing out in the most strident terms that only someone too stupid or too biased would realize that. And this comes from the prosecutors and the prosecution books and the inside books, and these people have toured the country denouncing the jury system in general and African-American jurors in particular, and it has created a national crisis.
You also mentioned that the blood drops themselves do not appear to have been made from or left by a fleeing subject, but rather appear to have been dropped deliberately from a relatively short distance above the ground.
Yes, listeners, try it yourself. Take an eyedropper, fill it with water. These blood drops that were found are without direction. They would have had to come from about 24 inches above the ground from a stationary position. I'm not even mentioning the blood that appears and disappears on socks and Broncos and back gates and so forth. I'm talking about the so-called blood drops to the left of departing footsteps at the murder scene. By the way, that's painted in a way, that word picture, which is far too precise. There are a few blood drops, but remember, And try it yourself. Pretend that you have a cut on your left hand and you're bleeding and walk across the room. Well, you'll find that your left hand moves and it doesn't, the drop won't always fall next to your left foot, will it?
No, obviously.
So, and it won't fall in a pristine drop, will it?
No, obviously. Although not so obviously to some of the people who followed the media distortions on the case.
That's right, because they're reading words which say blood drops next to the left foot, which, therefore, they must come from the left hand. But remember, first of all, they wouldn't be drops. Second of all, they wouldn't be next to the left foot. And third of all, remember, the footsteps reached the back gate, turned around, and returned, according to the state, in order to look for the missing glove and cap that the murderer had lost somehow. But the blood drops don't return and come back. They don't come back. But we are to take it that a murderer comes back, I suppose scratches his head, and looks around, and then shrugs his shoulders, not seeing the glove and hat, and walks away. But let me tell you, we're talking about 2 or 3 feet. We're talking about 36 inches. You have no idea how small the killing space is, where Mr. Goldman lay and where the glove and the hat were and where they were easily seen by the police. Now, if you were to see that Bundy killing space, you would realize that there is something wrong with the prosecution scenario about what those footsteps are telling us.
One of the things that you and your co-author did was to engage in a painstaking reenactment of the Bronco pulling up in front of Rockingham. In connection with Alan Park's testimony, the limousine driver. I wonder if you could briefly, because we have a great many points to get into in about, maybe 18, 17 minutes left in our this half of the discussion. But you and your co-author staged a demonstration and with some very objective and informed observers. Could you tell us about the demonstration? Who was your control observers and what did they find?
Yes, and this is the centerpiece of our book. And this is the climax of the timeline, and this is what the defense intends to use as their basic weapon in the civil case upcoming. And this is what the judge has so far refused to allow the jury to go to the Rockingham estate or to the crime scene. And this will create a crisis in the case very shortly. But what the defense intends to prove in the civil case, using, I believe, basically what we did and what anyone could do in our book. The following is this. At about 10:15 or 16, a young limousine driver turned his limo north of Sunset, up Rockingham Drive, and in the silence and the darkness drove slowly looking for the Simpson estate where he was to take the celebrity to the L.A. airport. This was the first time he had been there, and he was very concerned and even anxious to discharge his duty that night. And at 10:21 about, he arrived at Simpson's home and pulled around to, there are two gates, and he pulled around to the second gate, which is about 25 yards from the first gate at an angle, at a diagonal across the yard. And we know this because he then called his mother and he called his boss and he continued to call over the next half hour because he didn't see a light and he didn't see or hear Mr. Simpson and he was worried. Now, if you stand at that gate in the darkness with the crickets pulsing in the silence after 10 on a Sunday murder night, out of that silence, a white Bronco will come booming like a brass band, its headlights throwing 100 yards in front of it. No one, not comatose, could miss hearing or seeing Simpson or anyone else arriving at the home. And then we did the test without the motor on and without the lights on and in a clandestine manner, gliding into place by the gate. You can still hear and see. You are still aware. You are unwittingly providing Mr. Simpson with his alibi, and that's what the jury would see if they're taken up there. Because in a circumstantial murder case, it's not surprising that the alibi will be circumstantial. So it's the honest limousine driver, not what he sees or hears, but what he doesn't see or hear, that tells us that Mr. Simpson's alibi is basically validated, because if you can't enter and you can't leave by vehicle that estate after 10:21, then you are in effect locked in time in that mansion. and that is Simpson's alibi. And though you are only 6 minutes away from the Bundy murder scene, you might as well be in Paris or London. And you might as well ask, well, if he was in Paris or London, how could his blood have been found at the scene? But then you would be asking the question in the proper perspective. Here, on June 12, 1994, while the murders were taking place between 10:32 and 10:42 at the murder scene, based on the ear witnesses, after 10:21, no one can enter or exit the Rockingham estate because the young limousine driver is there looking and listening in vain for his celebrity charge.
Now, one of the points you also make, before we get to some unexamined evidence, is that one of the things that the prosecution used to attempt to show that O.J. was not there was the fact that the house appeared dark, and yet you and your co-author point out that that house can be fully lit and yet appear dark from the outside.
Well, absolutely. You have only to look at the tape, O.J. Simpson's tape, which we are forbidden to look at because we are told it's for profit and that it's self-serving, unlike every other institution in this utopia in which we live. But it's a historic tape, but self-serving, no more or less than anything else that's produced by human endeavor. But he shows you how the house is ablaze with light, but you can't see it from the gate. And he took his lawyers. He took Greta Van Susteren of CNN. He's taken a number of people to see this. So the young limousine driver was honest, all right, but he wasn't clairvoyant. But he's honest enough. He was never asked, remember, at the criminal trial, did you see or hear Mr. Simpson pull up in his Bronco? But he will be this time, and the answer will be no. And it is this Bronco experiment, I predict, will be to the Simpson affair what the Zapruder film was to the Kennedy assassination. And parenthetically, as David has talked about many times, the Zapruder film was a clock, a six-second clock, that home movie of President Kennedy's murder. And you could take it apart frame by frame and decide whether one man could fire four times.
And indeed, some of the clocks that you and your co-author provide show that O.J. Simpson was framed in this particular case. Don, we've got about 12 minutes. I'm going to attempt to do the impossible once again, as O.J. Simpson was alleged by the prosecution to have done. And I'm going to present a number of bullet points, or again, we're using perhaps a grotesque pawn knife points here, and get brief comments, although I am going to read one short passage from your book, which I think exemplifies the dramatic nature of the information that you and your co-author have dug up, but that has not been reported by the major media. One of the most important aspects of your book concerns unexamined pieces of evidence. I'm going to touch on these, and I'm just going to bring them up, and I want you to comment as briefly and succinctly as possible, and although obviously substantively. A mystery phone call placed at around 10:30 asking whether a double murder at Bundy had been investigated.
Yes, and that's been confirmed in a new book called A Problem of Evidence by Joe Bosco as well. That's a fact, but whether it means everything or nothing, we will never know until there's a new investigation, and that's what we're demanding.
Nicole's garage held some evidence that has not been brought to light.
Yes, it did. There's evidence of people waiting their change found on the floor. There's evidence that that's how the murderers, and there had to be more than one, as we find it, entered through that garage.
Blood under Nicole's fingernails did not match OJ's.
That is right. There was blood under her fingernail. There was blood on her back. There was blood on the keys to the car that Mr. Goldman had borrowed, and those keys were returned to the young woman who owned the car without the blood being tested, if you can believe that. There's an inventory. There's fingerprints, that 17 pairs that were not traced to anyone at that scene. The list is a long one.
The mystery DNA in the Bronco that has never been tested and that did not match any of the suspects or victims.
That is a fact. There was a trace of mystery DNA in the Bronco. Could that be from someone planting evidence?
A dog, the Akita, that belonged to Nicole, chased or apparently went after something or somebody in a direction the opposite of what the prosecution contends.
That's right, in the opposite direction of the footprints. The shoe prints. But remember, listener, the crime scene was hosed down within 12 hours.
Except for the back gate, of course. we'll get to the back gate a little later. But now, one of the things that is mentioned in a book by about Cato Kalin, and that author Stephen Wirth, who will be joining us shortly, brings up in his book, Blood Oath, is that O.J. Simpson had been getting threats from neo-Nazi and white supremacist groups, some of those delivered by sympathetic cops or sympathetic to the white supremacists within LAPD. Even the FBI had informed him about this. What I did not know until I read your book, Don, was that Nicole also had been getting both letters and threatening phone calls from neo-Nazi groups concerning not only her interracial relationship with O.J., but her connections with Jewish personages.
That's right. The lawyers and friends who were Jewish, there were threats, both physical and telephonic, surrounding, interestingly enough, all the principals in this case over a period of about a year at least.
O.J. Simpson's place had been entered the night before the murder, and apparently a strange message left on his answering machine in a foreign language.
That is correct.
O.J. Simpson had been cornered. He testified in his deposition before the police from June 13th that three cars had cornered him and cut him off. Could you tell us about that?
Well, that is correct. It's a question now of putting together these threats. Where are they coming from? What's the common denominator? Ron Goldman seemed to be working in an extremely dangerous restaurant subculture. What's the common denominator?
A 14-year-old boy who was a neighbor of Nicole's heard screams and saw three white men out and back. His parents have since received threatening phone calls, and they're undecided about whether to come forward.
That is true. We've tried our best, and we feel that there are a number of people that would come forward if there were a new investigation, but it would probably take that because the prosecution damaged and insulted everyone who wouldn't fit into their timeline.
In connection with the neo-Nazi threats, Nicole had actually asked O.J. to come around because she was worried, and she felt she was being observed and threatened by someone other than O.J.
That's right. She asked O.J. Simpson, her former husband, and other friends to try to pass by at night when they could because she was concerned.
Ron Goldman had received threats.
He had indeed threats to his life by someone who may have been obsessively jealous of him. Now, this is not, I want to be very careful. I'm not in any way suggesting that Mr. Goldman is to blame for his own death. And when his father attacked me recently on Larry King, I reiterated that only that since we don't know who the killer is, we don't know who the target was. And young Mr. Goldman, even had he been a saint, nevertheless was working in a bistro disco restaurant subculture where there have been other murders.
There have also been some deaths of people connected with some of the principals. You mentioned a record producer, Charles Minor, who was connected to O.J.?
Yes, there is a kind of a body count around this case.
A former co-waiter and friend of Ron Goldman's named Michael Nigg.
Yes.
Casimir Butch Casey Susharsky, a reputed organized crime associate of O.J.'s in his Buffalo playing days, was also murdered shortly after the killings.
Well, along with two women, yes, that's three in Florida.
A couple of friends of Ron are supposedly, according to your book, are in hiding now for fear of their lives.
Well, two have disappeared, three were murdered. That's Ron Goldman, Michael Nigg, and Brett Cantor. Cantor was stabbed almost exactly the same way Goldman was. And that Cantor murder was investigated by the same robbery and homicide squad for which that Lang and Van Adder, the detectives in the Simpson case, with which they were associated with robbery and homicide.
In discussing Stephen Singular's book, and we're going to be joined by Stephen Singular shortly here, in discussing Stephen Singular's book, Legacy of Deception, we analyzed the burglary of Jennifer Amelie's office. She was a psychotherapist who'd been counseling both Ron and Nicole and had some of her files burglarized. By way of underscoring, Donald, the importance of the information that you and your co-author have developed and how great the variance is with the public perception of the case, I'd like to read some of your actual text from pages 147 and 148.
Right.
Now, this concerns Dr. Jennifer Amelie, again, that psychotherapist who had some files burglarized, but what I did not know until I read your book was that there was a whole lot more going on around her than just burglarized files. Reading now from page 147 of Killing Time, Dr. Jennifer Amelie, A-M-E-L-I, a clinical psychologist who had counseled both Ron and Nicole, was in 1994 and 1995 harassed and threatened, her offices burglarized and case files stolen. A specialist in relationship, marriage, and family counseling, Dr. Amelie also works with drug-related problems and the Tarzana Rehabilitation Center and has a number of her clients in the entertainment field. In March of 1996, She detailed for our interviewer, Ian Bowater, is that the correct pronunciation? This list of intimidations. Early in 1995, an anonymous telephone caller asked to purchase the files of Nicole and Ron. Dr. Ameli refused. A few days later, her office in Santa Monica was broken into and some files were stolen. Police investigating the break-in removed from the scene other files and a bill addressed to Goldman. Concerned with client therapist confidentiality issues, Dr. Ameli reported this to the Board of Behavioral Sciences of the Consumer Protection Agency. A few weeks later, an unknown assailant approached Dr. Ameli from behind. He pushed and threatened her, telling her to keep her mouth shut about the Simpson case. She did not see his face or recognize his voice, but could only tell that he was tall. During this time, she also received threatening telephone calls. Sometime later, she was confronted near her Malibu home, which houses her second office. Subsequently, someone broke into her house and office. Fearing for herself and her family, Dr. Ameli reported all incidents to the police and asked for protection, but found them unsympathetic. She admits that her answers to police inquiries had to be evasive because she did not want to violate client confidentiality. She believes this may have antagonized the police. I was startled to read about this because I knew about the burglaries. I did not realize about the pattern of intimidation. And again, many of the people, virtually all the people involved with this case, victims and alleged perpetrator, have received threats, intimidation, and there's obviously a whole lot more to this case than just the official version.
It calls out for a new investigation, letting the computer chips fall where they may. It really does.
We have once again been told that this crime, which has riveted the national attention, was performed by a lone nut, basically, an out-of-control husband. And yet, who was threatening Jennifer Ameli? Who was following her around? Who threatened Ron Goldman? Who was placing the threats and the surveillance on Nicole and possibly OJ? There are many, many more questions than answers about this case. I think, however, that the work that you and your co-author have done, Don, have driven a white Bronco, I guess one could say, through the very middle of the official version of this case, one which sadly has been bruited about by the national media, which have taken the prosecution's allegations at virtual face value and not done any serious investigating.
That's right, and have turned around and blamed the jury and blamed the race of the jury and caused a great deal of mischief and trouble. And when the educated class is derelict, and when there's a failure of intellect and of character, such as in this case, then what started out as a minor media melodrama quickly escalates to become an emblematic crisis.
We've been speaking with Donald Freed, who, along with Raymond Briggs, is the co-author of Killing Time, the First Full Investigation, a very penetrating analysis of the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman and the investigation or alleged investigation into those. If listeners' appetites have been whetted from the admittedly truncated discussion of your book that we've been able to fit into the allotted broadcast time here, I strongly recommend that they go out to their local retail book outlet and pick it up or order it. Donald, I want to thank you for appearing on our program, and I want to thank you for your past work.
Thank you. We talk every time there's a need for dialogue, and when the conduits of the air and press, which are supposed to belong to the people but do not, then we can be very grateful for a program such as this.
I've been speaking with Donald Freed. For Donald Freed, this is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.